In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman. Thanks for joining me today for another session of the podcast. Be sure to go review and rate the show, guys. It's easy to do. It takes about 2 minutes out of your day. Just go to emsseo.com/iTunes. It'll take you right to the iTunes page, so you can go ahead and do that. It really helps out in the world of Apple. And today, I'm joined by Dr. Ken Lavelle. Ken, you with me still?
I am.
All right, perfect. I invited you today, Ken, a friend of mine, I guess another ex-partner of yours, Mike Welsh from Monarch in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. He was my partner a while back, and he had asked me to reach out to you. We were talking about a lot of the COVID stuff and some things that you're doing as a medical director and with agencies you're involved with. I want to get you on. I know a lot of stuff's going on with COVID right now, and it's kind of a hot topic. I know I've covered it a few times, but I'm trying to kind of bring it to people from the EMS perspective, you know, and kind of getting away from wash your hands, don't touch your face type thing, and get more into how it's affecting us and what our leaders are doing to try to help out people out in the field. So thanks again for joining me. But for people that don't know you, if you can just kind of maybe give a quick bio of yourself so we can get familiar with you.
Sure. So I started out as an EMT when I was 16 with the Ocean City Rescue Squad. Went to college, thought about med school, got tired of school, came back, worked in Atlantic City EMS, went to paramedic school in Ocean County College. Mike actually was in my class. And then I was running a Hamilton Rescue Squad, and I opened up a GEMS magazine, and I saw a guy leaning against a police car. But it wasn't a police car. It was said EMS medical director. And I said, well, that's cool as heck. You know, doctors can go out in the field with lights and sirens. So, you know, the whacker in me immediately started looking into med school. So I went to Jefferson for med school. And when I got out of residency there in emergency medicine, it was right around the time a lot of New Jersey squads were starting to look for a medical director. In the past, they had like their local family doctor do it, give them like, you know, EpiPen scripts, but that's about it. But it was starting to become more of a specialty. So, you know, I actually formed my own company. I had been doing that for training back when I was with Hamilton. But now, for the most part, I'm a full-time EMS medical director. I only work a couple days in the hospital at Jefferson every month. I cover a large number of agencies. I probably should start saying no, but there's not a whole lot of docs out there that are able to give the time. So I cover agencies from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, some ALS ones in Pensy, all the way down to also AMR in DC. They're the 911 supplement down there. They do basically BLS transports for DC fire and EMS. So that's kind of my experience. And I'm double board certified in both emergency medicine and EMS. There's only about 600 doctors nationwide that have double board certified in that specialty.
Wow. So you're busy.
I am. Yeah. Last night I was awake all night long with command calls, but we'll get into that. So as far as what are people calling me for, but yeah, a little tired this morning.
I think it's listen to that. I'll tell you, it's motivating. I think, because people can hear that, you know, being an EMS doesn't just have to be as an EMT, that there are career paths out there, ways to get involved, ways to branch out. So I think it's pretty cool. That you've done so much, you know, with your career. So Mike had mentioned to me about something that you had been, I was talking to him and other people about, you know, the call volumes going up, especially like in New York, New Jersey, and stuff like that. Other places I'm seeing where their call volumes are going down. They're not as busy as they usually are. But other places, like I said, New Jersey, New York, where it's going up, and I know New York City, have a lot of people I know in New York City who are experiencing call volumes of, you know, 6,000 to 7,000 calls per day, when the average is around between 3,000 and 4,000, a little over 4,000 would be a busy day, you know, during a snowstorm or something like that. And just talking to Mike and just kind of venting a little bit about And why aren't we doing something to alleviate sort of the non-emergent, you don't have to go to the hospital type calls, and pretty much telling people, no, you don't need to go to an emergency room, or at the minimum, you don't need an ambulance to take you to the emergency room. He said you released a protocol, I guess, that is allowing BLS protocol, and where the agencies don't have to transport patients that are not symptomatic, or even they just have some mild symptoms that might be flu-like or maybe even COVID in nature. So I'm just wondering, kind of maybe give some background on that and sure. how you got that out there.
You make a good point. You know, the call volume actually in South Jersey and here, you know, I live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania right now, is certainly lower. So, you know, we have a little bit of a concern about that because like somebody, one of the cardiologists said, where are all the heart attack victims? I mean, people are having fewer MIs nowadays than they did a month ago. So we're concerned that they're not coming in and they may be just staying at home. The other point is we're seeing a large number of patients that just, you're right, they never needed an ambulance and now they're smart enough to not call in. It was quite kind of similar after 9/11 when FDNY, New York City EMS at the time, said, hey, no, we're not, please don't call, we're a little busy. And then you flip it over to Bergen, to Union, Hudson County, New Jersey, and New York, where they're just getting slammed. So what I think what we're seeing is that those areas had patients become symptomatic like a week or two before other areas. And I use the phrase, we're watching it come down the turnpike. You know, it's slowly getting worse. I just was notified that a nursing home in Cape May County, which is probably one of the least hit in New Jersey, has 25 cases, 11 staff and 14 residents in a nursing home in Lower Township are positive. So the problem is a lot of these places we haven't been testing. So we don't know what we don't know. Everyone's like, oh, no, we don't have any cases in Atlantic County. Well, that's because the hospital systems there weren't testing unless we were really getting admitted. Well, that does not help us from an epidemiological standpoint. We need to know how many people get this and what kind of symptoms they have, what's the timeline, and that's going to help us for the next time. And it's very concerning that the lack of testing that's going on. But you're right. I did release a protocol. It was very mild. I mean, basically, you know, New Jersey is unique. I guess you could say that about every state, but we don't, as you know, we don't have a state medical director. So it's kind of like the Wild West here. And OEMS, as we also know, is in a little bit of turmoil as their recently their director was let go. Probably the worst time in the world to do this just before a pandemic. But the initial protocol I released was very, very basic. It basically said if a person said they just wanted to go get a test and they had no symptoms, that I considered them not to be a patient. And there was some debate about some EMS lawyers about that, you know, good natured debate. But I said, look, it's no different than if somebody says, well, I'm hungry. I want to go get dinner at the hospital. We'd be like, no, I'm not going to take you that. Or somebody who lives in New Brunswick says, well, I want to go to my doctor down in Delaware, the hospital in Delaware. No, you know, so we say no all the time. I did say at the time, if they are symptomatic, then we would take them. Now, since then, New Jersey has come out with assistance of the MAC, the Medical Advisory Committee, which is made up of the ALS medical directors, with a much more aggressive protocol that it's very similar to New York's. If you saw the New York flow chart, that basically says if their vitals are normal, they're not older, and they have mild symptoms like just a fever, then they can be a non-transport. And this is dramatic. I mean, we used the phrase before, provider-initiated refusals, which was a lousy term, but it meant basically where the EMS provider would say, you don't need to go to the hospital, and that was a QA nightmare. This is a little different because they have state guidance, and it requires online medical control. So those are the phone calls that I and the other docs in the state are getting as we try to prevent these patients from going to the hospital because there's a limited need at this time.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the QA nightmare of that, right? And kind of given the green light for providers to say you don't have to go. And I've had kind of discussions with other people about this, even on the podcast, where we talk about telling the frequent flyers and the people that call for the stub toe and the cut finger that you don't need to go to the hospital. And the argument being that a lot of providers, you know, especially EMT level, right, they're very basic training, where they're not trained enough to be able to say you don't need to go to the hospital, right? Know, grandma falls out of bed, and instead of just picking her up, putting her back in the bed and saying have a nice day, it's, well, you're going to go to the hospital type thing. And we don't have sort of the broader training in order to make that clinical decision of not transporting, you know, those patients. But you make a good point where this is guided by the state. You mentioned New York. I've seen that flowchart, right? It's made up by the state and the medical directors there so that you can follow that flowchart, you can follow that protocol to see that the patient fits into that. So you're not kind of just broad, you know, kind of like a broad sweep saying, oh, I feel you don't have to go, you don't have to go. The patient has to fit into those guidelines within that
flowchart, yeah.
You know?
True, yeah. And New Jersey essentially copied that. Unfortunately, they made a mistake in it. And because one of the complaints that to enter in the pathway is, well, the inclusion protocols is a fever. And then if you look at the third box, a fever means they have to go to the hospital. So the docs, we recognize that and eliminated it, that aspect of things. A fever by itself doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But it's and you're right. You know, there's been an argument for the longest time that EMTs, we extend their scope of practice, you know, like, for example, with albuterol, there's been a very large debate about, you know, are EMTs educated and trained enough to be able to recognize, for example, the difference between, you know, quote unquote, cardiac asthma or cardiac wheezing and COPD and asthma and make the clinical difference. And I'd like to hope most of my agencies do, because I've made it an issue to educate them. But you're right, you know, even with our EMT class now being, what, 220 hours, 240 hours, it's like, it's not enough. And one thing that people have to understand is, in almost every other state, the ambulance is coming with a paramedic on it. Okay. Like in Bucks County and in Colorado and California, the EMTs are on the first respond engine company and the paramedics are on the ambulance. You know, we have it different where our paramedics are delayed, and some places do an outstanding job. You know, I think Capitol Health in Mercer County does a very good job of covering their local. Virtua does a very good job of covering Burlington and Camden counties, but there are other projects in some other areas that don't do as good a job, and we're looking at those 25-minute response time. So it becomes a more pressing concern in those areas when the EMTs are having to make decisions, whether it be albuterol or even this non-transport of certain patients. So it's certainly a concern, but we're at the point now where it's risk-benefit ratio.
And this is this protocol applies to the volunteer agencies in New Jersey as well?
Well, that's the thing. They have their own sort of thing. The problem is volunteer squads don't have to be licensed, and they don't have to have a medical director. Now, that's something that the former director of OEMSO has debated, because he said, well, you have to have a medical director to get you have an AED. And that's true. You know, New Jersey had taken the approach of, you know, kind of like a carrot approach, that if you wanted to, if a volunteer squad wanted to carry, you know, albuterol, epi, Narcan, that they had to have a medical director. But there's no guarantee that every single volunteer squad has one or how actively they're involved. So while the policy does apply statewide, it, you know, they need to have access to be able to call a doc. And the first choice is their squad's medical director. The second choice they've listed is the poison control center. I can't wait to see how that's going to go. You know, calling the poison control center to ask if we can leave somebody home. Or hospital medical command, and some hospitals do it commonly, like Cooper Hospital, but others, you know, if you call the ER and said, I want to talk to a doctor, they'd be like, no, we don't know. You're not going to talk to a doctor. So, so it does apply statewide, but they have to have a mechanism to be in contact with some sort of online medical command.
And I guess I had also seen something where you're trying to, or maybe you already have, where you're updating that protocol so they can cancel the paramedics coming in if the patient only has a mild shortness of breath or flu-like symptoms, so that you're not, I guess, having a medic respond to that call and maybe exposing them, or, you know, diverting them from maybe something that should be responded to more.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I'll be the first to admit that, you know, practicing in other states, we treat a little bit more ALS. I mean, my mother was one of the first paramedics in Atlantic City. She actually had to train in Camden because there was no paramedics in Atlantic City. So back then it was, you know, medics just went to life threats. Well, that's not how EMS works in the rest of the world. You know, medics often will treat things like syncope. or even dizziness in an elderly, just because, well, if we can catch something, you know, we can do an EKG, you know, it's just, it's good patient care. Yeah. So I recognize that New Jersey is not exactly like that. And I sometimes put my providers in the middle because I'm like, hey, why did you cancel medics on this? But you're correct. And part of my protocol is if they have just very mild shortness of breath, flu-like symptoms, and they're satting, I forget what I wrote, I think I wrote 90% or more, and that's even on oxygen, then yeah, there's not much reason to have medics come in. I mean, let's face it, medics are going to do a great job with congestive heart failure, for example, but they can't do a whole lot with pneumonia. I mean, if somebody's got a pneumonia and they're satting 88% and they're not septic, there's not a whole lot of point in having the medics there. So I recognize that, and you're exactly right. I wanted to limit the exposure to them.
Yeah, it's, you know, I know that it's kind of tricky when you, especially with the volunteer end of it. I know when I was in New York City and then I came and I worked, came to New Jersey, and I remember things that you mentioned with the volunteer agencies not having medical directors. And I was told, well, you can just get, the ambulance could show up and they could just be a driver. They don't even have to be, you know, trained in CPR or anything, or even first aid. And I was kind of, you know, shocked about that. And then the other element of it with, you know, where they would get toned out, the volunteers would be getting toned out for kind of minor calls, and they didn't have anyone to show up. Eventually the dispatcher would upgrade the abdominal pain to a chest pain to get somebody there to justify the medics getting sent to the call, you know? So I guess it's kind of tricky when you don't have that, I guess, that medical direction for some of these agencies, I guess, you know?
Yeah, it's been historically a volunteer-based system in New Jersey.
Yeah.
What's interesting is I went to college up in Albany and to RPI in Troy, New York, and they had volunteer ALS agencies up there that functioned well. It's just a matter of oversight. And one of the common things we always complain about is EMS required? Well, other states have made it required, but New Jersey just had not.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. I remember working in Salem County as a medic and waiting an hour. We used to call mutual aid ambulances from Delaware to come over, and then the state made us stop doing that. This is 20 years ago. But yeah, there was one time where this patient was fairly stable. No ambulance was coming. So we didn't ride in ambulances. We were in Crown Vicks, and we basically followed him to Salem Memorial Hospital to make sure he could get there and nothing bad happened. So it does happen in some areas.
It's, and you know, the thing is too, one thing I noticed, like when you, like you mentioned the Abiraterol and stuff, I remember when they started doing that in New York City, they were letting the EMTs give Abiraterol, give assist a patient with their own nitroglycerin, things like that. And when they first implemented those protocols and put that on the EMTs to suddenly treat those patients, I noticed that because of the lack of training that some of the providers had, it was just like, oh, here's a quick, you know, see me on it, and now you can do this. And we would get to the scene, we'd be going to, you know, a difficulty breathing call, and we'd get there, and they'd be on scene for a good 10, 15 minutes before we got there, and they still wouldn't have them on the Abiraterol. And because they were nervous. They didn't know enough about what the drug was doing, about what they could do, just being uncomfortable with it without having the medic there sort of to be that backup for them to, in case something went wrong. Like you said, in case it was cardiac in nature and the patient ended up, you know, flashing over, and then now they've got nothing to help the patient. You know, they're there by themselves. So I kind of understand that. And I think that's something that's, I think, gotten much better over the years, and a lot of places I've seen that happen, where EMTs are given more responsibility in their scope of practice of what they can and can't do. But it goes back, I think, to a little bit about this, where now the protocol comes up and you're letting the EMTs not, you know, to make that decision, not, you know, not to transport the patients. And I wonder, the question I want to ask you is have you seen it working, or are you still seeing the EMTs kind of hesitant to initiate that refusal because they don't want to be held responsible should the patient, you know, become worse, or maybe something else is going on that they're not comfortable, can't diagnose or rule out for themselves on the scene?
Yeah, with my personal protocol for my agencies, I only got one or two calls. You know, fortunately, most people were not saying, I just want to go get a test, because, you know, hospitals and the media was kind of communicating that that's not a reason to go to the hospital. But right. New Jersey implemented their protocol statewide for minor symptoms on Monday. So we were just at the beginning. But yes, I probably took 5 or 6 calls in the last 24 hours from different agencies for people like that. And the only thing that they've been nervous about is like, well, what happens if the patient really insists? And I said, well, and I gave the same examples I gave at the beginning of our talk. I was like, you know, if they said they wanted to go to Jefferson, you'd be like, no. So I said, sometimes you have to tell people no. And we're used to that as doctors when, for example, they come in with a kid comes in with a fever and an ear infection and the parents want antibiotics. We have to be able to explain it to them that no, that's not what's indicated. So, you know, we can't always allow patients to dictate care. That's our job as doctors to know, but we also have to be able to communicate to that with them. And, you know, as well as I do, EMS providers aren't always the best communicators. We found that out when we were starting to pronounce patients on the scene. You know, we just don't talk to people very well. We're very class A personalities, and sometimes we like our unconscious patients better than conscious ones. So it's one thing we all have to work on, better communication. And, you know, in this situation, it's even more so.
Yeah. So I guess one of the questions that I always kind of come back with, some, even like with 9/11, I remember on 9/11 and stuff and being there, you know, myself on 9/11 and triaging people and people like requesting to go to want to go to a hospital that's nowhere near close to facility. Like people still have that, I guess, that mentality that the ambulance can just do their bidding and take them to wherever they want to go. Do things like you said, just take me there because I want to get checked out type thing. I know there's a place North Carolina where they were talking about that, getting a lot of patients were calling because they wanted to have their temperature taken, you know, type thing. They didn't want to go to the hospital. They just wanted the ambulance to come and take their temperature type thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because we don't even, most agencies don't carry any thermometers on the ambulance. I mean, yeah. Some were, but most do not.
Yeah, they were carrying the, you know, the temporal temperature thermostat to take the temperature there. And it's just, I have to ask, and this is something 9/11, I started thinking, you know, as a medic there, that maybe the fact that we were able to, like you said, tell people no, and to treat the ambulance as an emergency resource for people having a heart attack, having a stroke, you know, difficulty breathing, trauma, stuff like that, that because we were changing things up for 9/11 because of the overwhelm of patients and resources and stuff like that, that it was going to continue once things died down, you know. And I'm wondering, and this is something I've been asking people that I speak to on the podcast or off the podcast, and I'm just going to, the idea of when this dies down and we're flattening of the curve and all that, and things kind of get back to normal. Do you think that some of these protocols to tell patients that they can't use an ambulance for a transport, or that they can use, like a lot of telemedicine that goes on nowadays too, to keep people from going to the ER, do you think that's going to something that's going to end up continuing on, or are we just going to go back to normal, just take everyone that wants to go, you know, wherever they want to go without question, because that's what we do and we're afraid of getting, you know, afraid of litigation?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's the, do I think it'll continue? No, I think we're going to go back to normal, quote unquote normal. Do I think we should allow it to continue? Absolutely. I mean, we have an opportunity here where we could change, you know, how EMS does things. And we've obviously, we've learned in the last 3 months that we've messed a lot of things up in this country with not having enough PPE, just in time delivery, you know, that sort of thing. You know, I don't know if you know Bill Rosen, a colleague, posted a comment. He's like, well, why is this new protocol only for flu-like symptoms? Why can't we also tell the people that stubbed their toe to no, go to an urgent care?
Right.
The government is working on that. If you're familiar, they have the Medicare came out with their E-triple-T, I think that's what it is, kind of proposal, and it was going to, and different agencies have signed up to participate this. It's going to be a voluntary 5-year pilot where ambulance services can get paid to take somebody, for example, to an urgent care, or even to a doctor's office, and alternative delivery models. So, you know, based on the problem is New Jersey is just so fragmented with a system. I mean, both by ALS versus BLS and also by every single town. But if you could imagine like Montgomery County, Maryland Fire Rescue, where they're all one entity, they might be able to deal with a dispatch. Somebody calls in and says, well, yeah, I stubbed my toe and I'm afraid I might've broken my foot. Well, they might be able to say, okay, well, based on their screening, they might send one provider in an SUV to pick the patient up, assess them, make sure there's nothing else going on, and then take them to an urgent care. So it's going to be, you know, we'll get paid for things. But that the corollary to that is that also tells me that in 5 or 10 years, Medicare is not going to pay for these. Like if we bring that right now, that, you know, you call, we haul, and we get paid. But they're going to start saying, no, he didn't need to go to the ER, so we're not paying you. So they're going to make EMS become the gatekeepers. And we all know that other insurance tends to follow exactly what Medicare does as well. So, you know, I think it's an example that we could look at to say, hey, this worked okay. We could do this. But let's just say I don't think New Jersey's going to do it anytime soon because we just don't have that kind of organization in the state.
Yeah. I feel like New York's the city anyway won't be doing it too quick either. I think they're very lawyer happy there, and they're always a little hesitant on that stuff, even with their cardiac arrest protocol that they changed because of this about not transporting people, in cardiac arrest to the hospital. Meanwhile, many, many places across the country have been doing that for years. And it's nothing really new, but they act like it's the end of the world because people found out, oh, my God, you're not going to transport grandma to the hospital if she's in cardiac arrest. How can you do that, you know? And I don't think New York's going to be too hip on the whole telling people no and they can't go. I remember working in New York City and people wanted to go from Brooklyn all the way to Manhattan for, you know, just because that's where they're doctor was, or they had cancer at one point and want to go back to that hospital, and it's got nothing to do with the cancer or nothing to do with their doctor, but that's where they want to go, and we'd have to call medical control to get approval. It was a whole thing, and that's when you start feeling like, you know, EMS starts feeling like they're the taxi, you know, and they get the stupid taxi t-shirts and the, you know, the taxi little metal things and all that stuff to try to, you know, kind of cry out that that's what they feel like they are. And like you said, this is an opportunity, I think, to really kind of take a step back and think about that. You know, I know that in North Carolina, they have a nurse in the dispatch and they don't not send an ambulance, but they triage the call in a way so that they prioritize that call. So that the person, if it is just a stub toe, they won't send an ambulance if they've got a bunch of other calls going on that are higher priority. They just, that call gets, you know, pushed back to the bottom, you know.
Yeah, you know,
rather than just sending it in order, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's amazing because, you know, Camden City's done that for years. You know, we would hear back when university had the contract, and even now, you know, Camden County Communications would say, you know, call the supervisor and they say, hey, we're holding 3 BLS and 1 ALS. And they'd say, okay, mutual aid for the ALS and park the BLS. And that's fine. And, you know, police do that all the time. You know, if they're going right after a shooting or something like that, they, you know, the dog barking calls are parked. But right, one of my chiefs down in Millville, you know, he tried to get that down there in Cumberland County, and the dispatchers, oh, we can't do that. We have to send an ambulance right away. It's like, why? I mean, this is the kind of thing where, because we don't control, for example, the EMS down there didn't control the communication center, you know, we have this fragmented system. So it's very difficult to advance things.
Yeah. I think it's like you said, I think it's going to come down to money. Unfortunately, what it's going to end up coming to where Medicare, Medicaid is not going to pay for that. And EMS will become the gatekeeper and other insurance companies will follow suit. And then when EMS isn't getting paid for things and you know, the states aren't getting paid and getting, you know, getting their funding, they're going to take a harder look at it, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be good, because then at that point, at least if they start doing that refusal type thing, the provider, you know, initiated type refusals, then they'll have more time to kind of implement it at a slower rate, more control, with more training to the providers and stuff like that, so that it's, you know, less of a chance of somebody making a mistake and somebody dying because they didn't get an ambulance or they didn't get transported, you know, to the hospital. So maybe in the end, that'll be a better thing, but I just hope it doesn't take forever.
Yeah. And you make a good point about the, you know, the cardiac arrest in New York. I misread that. When I first heard about it, I thought that they weren't going to be working the codes. And then, you know, then I realized that, no, they're just implementing kind of what we're already doing in many areas. I mean, I know, for example, down in some counties in Maryland, basically they never do CPR in an ambulance. They basically, if the patient recodes, they pull over and stop and work them for a while. Now, obviously, never say never, but they, you know, you work them on scene. And, you know, that was one of the things when some of the medics projects in Jersey implemented that. I was obviously a complete fan of it, but it was a hard sell for some of my agencies. And even in the past 6 months, yeah. I had a police department from one of my agencies say, well, we can't be sitting here for 45 minutes. And I'm like, well, I really don't need you, so go away. I mean, it's like we're not going to do what's wrong for the patient. We all know, you know, and that's one of the big things I view in my job as a medical director is I need to be able to explain, you know, the science, explain, you know, traditional medicine in the hospital down to the level of the EMS provider and even a non-certified one, because, yeah. You know, and that's my job is to be, I need to be able to explain, hey, this is why this is important. And I've done that with a few cases and if some of my protocols and the provider's like, oh, I never thought about that. And it's like, yeah. So, you know, that's what we do in medicine. So,
yeah. Well, Dr. Lavelle, I really appreciate you joining me. I love what you're doing there, and I love the insight you gave on some of these guidelines, maybe put in a bit of perspective. And I think, you know, people might be listening was going to give them a little hope that maybe someday it'll be kind of standard practice to be able to kind of triage on scene based on, you know, what patients are presenting like and not having to wait for some pandemic to come around to go ahead and force, you know, this to happen. Is there anything else you want to bring up or mention before we cut out for the day?
No, I think just, you know, this, you know, a couple of the issues that I've been dealing with, and I just want to encourage everyone to, you know, take care of themselves. You know, one of the biggest issues I've been having is hospitals telling our EMS providers what PPE they can wear into the hospital or not. And I just want to make sure everyone follows the CDC guidelines, listen to the doctors, don't listen to the, you know, everyone likes to bash the media or bash a politician, but, you know, listen to the people that make sense and know what they're talking about. Dr. Fauci is a wealth of information, and he's been there, done that, and he's designed t-shirts. So, you know, when he says something, I kind of listen, but take care of yourselves, follow the protocols, and ask questions of your medical director. Other than that, thank you for having me on board here.
All right, great. All right, everyone, that's it for today. Thanks for taking a listen. Like I said, be sure to go to iTunes and check us out there and leave us a review. And go to emsofficehours.com and check out the previous podcast and the videos and content there. And as always, I am Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.